So this bolt of lightning shot across the universe and inspired me with the idea that we have to do a podcast. And that's what I wanted to tell you. We should do a podcast. Okay, bye.
Okay. Yes, I hit record.
Okay, fantastic.
We have hit record.
Welcome to Feature Creep, colon.
Built-in microwave, semicolon.
Cliche. The first cliche.
The first cliche.
Yeah. Sorry. the original. We are the original cliche. I mean, our podcast is a kind of a cliche in itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, no, you know, it just is.
The fact that the things we talk about have even filtered all the way down to us to our awareness level means that they're probably cliche.
Right. Right. All right. Well, let's see. So this is our podcast. I'm Ned and this is Meg. And we are going to talk about art and design ostensibly. But really, it's about the reunification of Europe.
Funny.
So the front matter is that if this is the first podcast you're listening to, we would love to hear from you. You can email us. And the person you can email is Dana. She is the CEO and founder of this podcast. And that's D-A-N-A at fcbm.io. And you can send her all kinds of emails. And we will get them. You can send them an email. And Meg and I will, you know, Dana will look at it and be like, okay, you know, do we need to answer this or not? And here you go.
She'll eviscerate it, and then she'll pass it along to us, and then we'll write you back and apologize.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Yeah. That will not happen.
No, that will not happen.
Not exactly like that.
Like, who knows what will happen. But one thing we can definitely say is we will try to take your personal information very seriously in terms of, like, we're not interested in collecting your email address, nor are we interested in sharing it with other people, nor are we interested in publicly sharing any of your ideas without your express consent. So that is, you know, what we strive to do. I don't know if we have that in writing or anything. I mean, you're just fucking sending an email on the internet, so good luck. If we receive it, that's our mentality when we're trying to deal with it. Anyway, cliche, here we go. So the idea, what is the idea? What's the deal?
So the wiki article that we are jumping off from says, a cliche is an element of an artistic work, saying, or idea that has become overused to the point of losing its original meaning or effect, even to the point of being weird or irritating, especially when at some earlier time it was considered meaningful or novel. That's one sentence. I love that explanation.
Yes.
Even to the point of being weird or irritating.
Yes. Yeah.
Especially if it was considered to be meaningful or novel at some previous time.
Yeah.
That's great. So it goes on to say, the term is often used in modern culture for an action or idea that is expected or predictable based on prior event. So in other words, like, derivative was the word that you used earlier when we were talking about Andy Warhol.
Yes. Yeah.
Typically a pejorative phrase or word. Cliches, the word cliches, may or may not be true. Some are stereotypes, some are truisms or facts. Cliches are often employed for comedic effect, especially in fiction. Most phrases now considered cliched were originally regarded as striking, but have lost their force because of overuse.
Right.
So yeah, it's something that's played out.
Like, we live in an age of, like, hyper cliche, because one person posts on their influencer Instagram the idea of living one day at a time or whatever, and then and then 50 other people pick it up and share it, and the next thing, by the time we see it, it's like an overused cliche that's, like, lost all its meaning, right? And and one could argue some of the Gen Z humor is based on that cycle, right?
Yes,
it's based on that idea of, like,
the awareness of it, right?
The awareness of how cliche something is until it's lost all meaning. And then it's funny. It's like, I think it's why some people struggle to get Gen Z humor, is it's like, it just seems like this chaotic mash of everything. But someone who's like laughing at it is probably someone who sees all of the elements and the strands of where that all comes from without even thinking about ways to contextualize that. It's just like inherently obvious to them because yesterday they saw these things and today they're seeing these things. And now just in this moment, they're seeing this mashup that really tickles because it's like, look at how these cliches are like entirely unrelated. And yet here they are together on this insane image. And, you know, we're looking at this like fucking baby holding a pickle, smashing a brick wall or something, like, you know what I mean? But it's like all the elements are there.
And then it's also, like, it's like the like meta cliche is like all of the cliches together at one time.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
I appreciate cliches. Like, I appreciate, like what this wiki article says, that they're most often employed for comedic effect. I think that's maybe one of the only saving graces of cliches for me, is how well that they can be employed to like make people laugh.
Yes, yes, yeah. Right.
Oh, who doesn't love making people laugh?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's, and so I think, like, so just before we started the podcast, and the reason I think we decided to go at this topic was that you asked me the question about Andy Warhol because I was raving or ranting. I was on a bit of a tear about how I felt that all of his, or how I perceive all of his artwork to have been both cliche at the time, but also to just have continued to spawn like an artistic cliche trend that is, to my mind, like not appealing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's fine if you find it appealing. I'm just saying, like, I think it's cliche the whole way down, right? Like, you know, most people know only really two pieces of his art famously, like the Marilyn Monroe sort of headshot and the Campbell soup can, right? Mm-hmm. And by definition, those are both cliche. Like, it's an image of something that we all know so well that it's completely lost its meaning. Like, now it's a fine art painting on the side, you know, this tomato soup can, like,
fine art painting. Yeah, and it's not like expensive fancy soup either. Like, the art is not portraying it because it's trying to like pedestalize or like glorify it. It's like the mundanity of the object is what makes it a worthy subject and so cliche.
Right.
The ubiquity of it, the fact that we like look at like, it's even Campbell's soup is a cliche because it is so far abstracted from like the things that go into making it a soup in the first place.
Right.
Like, it's a cliche of tomatoes.
Yes, it's a cliche of tomatoes. Yes.
And then we make a painting of a cliche of the cliche of the thing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's just lost. It's not soup anymore. And yet it makes you think of so, like, it's just what?
Like, Andy Warhol for me is like on some really basic instinctual aesthetic level, I like how his shit looks.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But like, if you're trying to assess the artist's statement behind it, like what the art is trying to make you think or feel, or what the art is commenting on by virtue of its existence in the world.
Yeah.
It starts to get a little confusing for me.
Sure. Yeah.
Because like, I want to love it. I mean, at first glance, I love Warhol, which is why I was like, if somebody just dumped an original Warhol painting in your lap, would you accept it? Mm-hmm. And I like,
oh yeah, so you had a question.
Both you and I were like, I don't know if I would.
So like, my thoughts on that are like, so I think the premise of the question was, if I had the opportunity to own a Andy Warhol original,
yes,
with the caveat that it did not cost me any financial output, right? It's just like someone's like, you can have, you know, like, here, would you like to have one of these from my collection? I would love for you to have it, no strings attached. And my answer to that is, it depends, because for me, if I'm in a position where it makes a strong public statement about me rejecting it, right? So it's like, oh, Ned wouldn't even take one of those paintings, and that's the story that gets, like, that's the thing that I can convey, then that's worth a lot to me, right? Like, potentially the, you know, $100,000 worth of value that I've just rejected. However, if it's more like, no one's going to fucking care or know, then I'll fucking take the $100,000 value object. Like, yeah. Sure, like, I'm not immune to the needs of, like, having economic need in order for my life to be, you know, easier for me, right? Like, where I don't have to work as much or potentially, you know. But again, at no point am I acquiring that with the idea that there's artistic value in it that I want to have. Beyond, like I said, the rejection of the artistic value by saying, hey, can I make a statement about saying I reject this as something that I think is artistically valuable?
Yeah.
On some levels. Yeah, yeah. I want to be really clear. Like, all accounts of creation are fantastic, no matter how small. And people doing art that I don't like is like, I'm in support of it, you know, to an extent. Yeah. Like, you know, if that art isn't harming people in a way that's, you get my point.
Anyway. Yeah. As long as it's not detrimental. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like, I, you know, like paint it, like, all the bad paintings. Somebody's going to love it and like fucking great, you know, and I'm not mad at people for liking Andy Warhol.
Mona
like,
Lisa.
Mona Lisa. Great. Fantastic.
Talk about a cliche.
Yeah. Seriously. Yeah.
I mean, like, the Mona Lisa was painted as a portrait of a rich person in Italy. Yeah. And like, the relationship between artists and rich patrons is like very intertwined going way back.
Yes.
And so, like, I think the real meaning of the Mona Lisa has become completely obscured, whatever it may have been. I mean, it was just like a dumb painting. Like, nobody, it's so weird how that particular painting became so famous.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it just is not like a great example of a painting based on any of the metrics you would usually judge a great piece of art by.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't actually, it's very small and it wasn't really mysterious to begin with. And it was just a painting of like a rich person's wife in Italy, which was mostly how like artists were paid, is like making portraits of rich people who were like, thanks, I'll give you money for this. And like, it's interesting to me that for some reason that painting has captivated like the public consciousness, but it shows up on dish towels and like in parodies and on like fucking t-shirts when you shop at the Louvre.
Right.
And you know what I mean? Like the original, whatever the original meaning of it may have been as a work of art, that has been completely obfuscated over time, which I think basically fulfills the basic definition of what a cliche is.
Yes.
And so, like, yeah, these artworks that, I think artworks become cliches when they sort of like take on this public persona that spirals off into pop culture meaning irrespective of the original intended purpose of the art or the creation of the art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I think even the Louvre itself is cliche at this point.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, that's the nature of this discussion, right? Is it's like, you know, the word itself can lose all meaning and just become a cliche of itself. And that's fine. Like, that's, I enjoy that. There was something you said about the style of Andy Warhol versus like the particular art. There's another artist that I think of that I kind of feel the same way, which is so Patrick Nagel did.
Yes. Oh my God. Like, yes. The like highly stylized ladies from the 80s.
Yes, exactly. And it's very much this like, you know, completely negative white space for skin, and then just like fine lines to define particular spaces and very little limited amount of like shadowing and shading and things like that. With these like vivid sort of hyper sort of neon pastels.
Yes.
You know, bright sort of like pinks and like I would say like
lavender,
fuchsia and teal and black, right? Black, white, fuchsia and teal is like the color palette.
Yes.
And it's for sure like the iconic like 80s neon. There's a term for it.
There's like jewel tones.
Jewel tones. Yeah.
He was born in 1945. November 25th, 1945 in Dayton, Ohio. Like, his stuff was so stylized. Like, you could not go into a hair salon in the 1980s and avoid his work. Like, posters of his were all over everybody's, because they captured, like, this impossible to actually achieve aesthetic of the 1980s, of this, like, perfect, highly produced, sculpted, extra geometric, like, appearance of people's bodies and faces and hair. Like, it was like these very, like, at the same time, they were very distorted, and yet they conjured up imagery of exactly what, like, you knew it was so recognizable. You're like, oh, I know people that look like this.
Yes. Yeah.
Even though these are like really glorified line drawings of people. Yeah.
Yep.
I always loved his shit. Like, I would, if somebody gave me an original of his, I'd be like, going in the living room.
Yes.
Gonna look at it every day.
I lived in a granny flat behind a house in college, and they're on one wall. So when the people rented it to me, they were like, oh, you know, really sorry. Like, our daughter's like fiance or whatever, like when they lived here, like painted this thing on the wall. And it was this like giant Patrick Nagel replica, like just painted right onto the wall. It's like the one of the woman kind of like with one knee up, and she's like wearing like a loose sweatshirt or something. Uh-huh. And, you know, and her knees are up. So it's like nothing's quite exposed, but it's very like seductive. Right.
Yeah.
And, or that sort of like that like innocent seductive look of like, oh, I'm just lounging around in the living room in my super loose bulky sweatshirt and nothing else.
I'm just a model with no pants on.
Yeah, exactly. And so anyway, it was there. And it was, and the problem was, it was such a good reproduction that I was like, they were like, we don't really want to get rid of it, but we'll paint over it. I was like, no, don't paint over it. Like, if it really bothers me, I'll hang something there. But like, I'm like, it's fine. And so I lived with that for like 2 years, like on my wall, this like massive, it was so big. It was like probably like 5 feet tall or something.
Oh,
like
my God. Just a giant wide.
Just covered like the whole
like
wall.
A giant woman.
Yeah. It's just a giant woman. Yeah, it was like, really, it was pretty funny. And that's actually how I'd seen his artwork, because I grew up in the 80s, so I was like passingly familiar with it. But that was the first time I was like, oh, who is this artist? And then, like, you know, learned more about him.
Yeah, you can, I mean, and the people in his images always have dark hair, dark features, so like dark eyebrows, dark eyelashes, and like impossibly white skin.
Yeah, just impossibly high contrast everything, right? It's just
super, super high contrast.
Yeah.
And any of the line work is like very minor and very detailed. Yep. So like there's huge washes of color or whiteness or like background color, but the distinctions between these blocks of color are these tiny, tiny, fine, super fine lines that like outline the body or the hands or the facial features or whatever. So it's like the color palette for these pictures is maybe like 3 or 4 tone, and that's it.
Yep.
Including black and stark white. It's really interesting, and it's just like such a visual impact. I also, whenever I see his paintings, they immediately make me think of the Robert Palmer videos with the women playing guitars with no bras on in the background. Same aesthetic, exactly, except they used like real human beings and tried to make the real human beings look exactly like the artwork.
Yes.
And the artwork was also imitating something else. So there you go. There's the cliche, right? Around and around and around and around until the original meaning has been lost. And now we just recognize the thing for itself. Like,
yeah.
Crazy. It's,
yeah. So the crazy thing is, so he died when he was 38, I think. And it's really? So dumb because, I mean, it's not.
Oh, 45 to 84.
Yeah. He died. He did a 15-minute celebrity aerobathon to raise funds for the American Heart Association. This is the tragedy. He died from a heart attack because of a heart defect that went undetected his entire life.
Oh my fucking God.
It's so sad. And like, it's also like a cliche, right? It's just like, how the fuck, like, or no, I guess it's kind of an irony.
It is an irony, but it's also like a cliche because there's a whole ton of people who were like health nuts who ended up having heart attacks and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's funny because it's like, well, you couldn't have actually been that healthy and this stuff couldn't have actually been that good for you because you're dead now because you didn't bother to check.
Yeah.
I mean, not everybody bothers to check. I, on the other hand, if I ever drop dead of some heart problem, it wasn't an accident. It wasn't a suicide. I've been saying I'm pretty sure there's something wrong with my heart my whole life, and everybody keeps telling me I'm a hypochondriac. So when I drop dead, it's not going to be ironic. It's just going to be tragic.
It's just going to be tragic. Yeah.
But you know, when that does happen, I will die in a state of complete satisfaction at knowing that ultimately I was right the whole time.
Right.
And then it'll be fine because I'll have been right.
Yep.
You know, most of the time, philosophy people don't care about being right or wrong. They care about the truth. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I noticed about the sort of like style of these things, speaking of philosophy, is that they kind of remind me of like the theory of forms, like mm-hmm. Plato's theory of forms, because all of these Nagel women and men, he also had men as subjects of his art too, and the Warhol subject material, like it's all imitating something that's like hyper recognizable to all of us, like some form of something that we're all familiar with. Mm-hmm. And yet like they don't have to be exactly the thing for us to think, oh, that's one of those things.
Right. Right.
And it's like, it's interesting to me that like the thing that they're imitating becomes so knowable mm-hmm. that anything that is not that thing but kind of looks like that thing just serves to reinforce the thing that we're all thinking of.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. It's super weird. It's so strange.
I guess that's what makes things recognizable. It's like the style.
Yeah.
You know, I did notice that Patrick Nagel has one... piece of artwork that is untitled, but the parenthetical title is Woman with Horse. And it's a person with a horse. And yes. I'm like, horse is also cliche.
Yes, yes, right.
Women with horses, another cliche in and of itself.
Yep, yep.
Oh my God, so funny. Women eating salad has become a cliche. Happy, like overjoyed women eating salad has become a cliche.
Right. Yeah.
That's a weird one.
Yes, that is a weird one.
I'm going to make a note of that. Warhol, Nagel, women with salads. You can open any beauty magazine and you'll see some woman who's like just, I didn't just win the lottery. I just put some cucumber ranch on my lettuce. But you wouldn't know from looking because I am experiencing the type of ecstasy that only comes from the mistaken belief that inheriting a shitload of money is going to be good for you, or hard drugs.
Or hard drugs.
So either the salad is just coated in drugs, or it's not really about the salad.
Mm-hmm.
Women with salads. Oh, women with yogurt, too.
Yeah, women with yogurt. Yeah. Which I find it funny because usually the yogurt, the companies that are promoting that are selling you sugar with a splash of yogurt on the side.
Yeah, they're like, you know, this yogurt is so sugary that it's going to feed all of the pathogenic bacteria and funguses in your gut biome, which is why it's really great that it comes with bacteria loaded inside, because you're going to need it.
You're going to need it, yes.
Live and active cultures for the sugar you just pumped into it.
Right.
Insane. Speaking of like, okay, sugar is a total cliche. Like sugar is in so much shit now that people don't even realize that like all this stuff shouldn't actually have sugar in it. Mm-hmm. Like
peanut butter.
Yes. Why is there fucking sugar in peanut butter?
I don't know.
That's crazy. I think people just like the taste of sugar. It's like everything just becomes a vehicle for the sugar, right?
That can't be right.
But like you and I were doing a synthetic biology conference the other day.
Yes.
And they were talking about like, they were talking about sweeteners that were not sugar and how they wanted to try and trick people into eating something that tastes like sugar but isn't sugar.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and it's this like workaround to get people to accidentally be more healthy by accidentally eliminating sugar from their diet without them even knowing it's missing, because the thing they're replacing with it, the sugar with, is like this zero calorie sweetener. And and so like nobody has to do anything different, but they get all these benefits that they're not getting now because they're eating sugar. And I'm like, wouldn't it be just easier to make some kind of regulation that prevents people from putting that much sugar in their shit?
Or fucking just put shit on the shelves that doesn't have sugar in it and give people the choice. Like, I think a big problem with this is that, like, I go to the supermarket, you can't buy shit that doesn't have sugar in it most of the time. It's like peanut butter. It's hard to find the peanut butter without sugar in it.
Yeah.
Just
you have
as an
to go
example.
To the crazy co-op and grind your own.
Exactly. It's not, that's why I would say that it's I think we both had the same idea when that guy had said that. We're like, no, no, no. The problem isn't that people want to eat sugar all the time.
The problem is we have no choice.
Yes, that's the real issue.
Right.
Like, I'm not, look, I love sugar. I fucking love it. Same. And some days I'm just like, oh my God, like, I just want to have, you know, ice cream milkshakes. And then I'd like to follow that up with a big slice of carrot cake. And then can we have donuts after that? And then I don't know what we're going to have for lunch, but it better have, like, you know, whipped cream on top of it. Like, right. For sure, that's in my mind. Like, sounds amazing. But
yeah, and none of the plain whipped cream. We're talking about whipped cream with sugar in it.
Oh, 100%. Vanilla, sweetened, sugared whipped cream, or, you know, chocolate powder in there. And no. Like, none of that bullshit. Like, heavy, thick whipping cream, thick fucking, Anyway, icing, but. You know, but it goes on top of the icing.
Like the kind I was eating that Thanksgiving we were together and I had refeeding syndrome after not being able to eat solid food for three or four weeks after getting my wisdom teeth out.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
That was fun. It was worth it, though.
It was worth it. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But but anyway, I think we both had the same idea where it's like the issue isn't that people have sweet cravings that need to not be satiated with sugar. Like, it's not that we can't have sugar or that it isn't necessarily bad for you.
Yeah.
Or I mean that it is bad
they
for
like,
it's just like fucking give me the choices where it's like if I buy food it's not adulterated with sugar. I can add it as needed. Like it's like that study they did where they added no salt to food and then they put salt out for people to add themselves and the amount of salt intake that people got from their meals was way more in line with what they needed as opposed to too much.
Yes.
Like it was like, oh, it turns out people are generally able to self-regulate the things they need when they're given the ability to do that as opposed to given something that's like oversalted or oversugared.
Right. When the choice isn't preemptively removed from their capacity. Yeah. Like that's, you know, this to me is like one of my greatest pet peeves in life is I would say it even extends beyond pet peeve. One of the things that I find absolutely intolerable.
Yeah.
From an existential perspective is being set up to fail. And I feel like the thing with sugar and food is basically like since none of us who live in the city have the capacity to raise our own food for the most part, I have a tenth of an acre and I'm trying to figure out if it's even like physically possible for me to raise enough food that Damon and I could just eat it for the year if we were able to store it. Right.
Right.
And I don't think we could, but not based on the amount of arable land that we have. Anyway, my point is like, so because we are in a society and I define society as a group of people working towards something together, like the combined products of a group of people and combined efforts of a group of people, right? You can draw the line around whichever society you want. The society here in Minneapolis, Minnesota is a bunch of people who live in the Twin Cities. We generally have yards. If we all started farming them, we'd probably do okay because we could work with each other to figure out how to solve these problems and things and make enough produce to feed us all. But like,
and variety too, right?
And variety, right. Yes. So largely, like, without massive restructuring of the society that we're in right now and without changing everything about how we operate on a day-to-day basis and supply foods for ourselves, we are dependent on other people who make and produce foods for us. And the choices they make are choices that we just have to live with or we don't eat. Right.
Right.
And so it's really upsetting to me for like you to be handed essentially an abstract concept of like, here's a box full of things. These are the box is full of your food choices. These are all of the foods that you can access geographically, financially, or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And here are the choices that you're offered. And then you're like, okay, well, I have choice A, B, and C of these food items. I'm going to choose A. And they're like, well, fuck you. You eat too much sugar and you're like a problem eater because you have too much sugar in your diet. Well, that choice was made for me before I ever had access to decide how much sugar should go into it. Like these choices were made upstream. When you hand me a basket of choices and the choices in there all preemptively come with conditions that are not suitable. And then I am forced to choose among those options. And then I am held responsible for the negative effect. That's bullshit. And I think that sums up the existential problem of our time. Me, you, everyone else alive right now, which is that that upstream from all of us as individuals, we are having choices that are made for us, and we only get to select from the range of options that are predetermined. And when we make those predetermined selections, we are held responsible for the repercussions as if we manifested those choices in the first place. And we fucking didn't. And solving everybody problem, blaming everybody and forcing everybody to solve for end cases as individuals is one of the biggest scams that has been perpetrated on us as a society, because it removes the choice to change anything.
Yep.
Upstream. And it's fucking bullshit. And it's not all of our fault, because we don't actually have control over the choices that were offered in the end.
Right.
Soapbox. Rant over.
Fucking, no, it's nuts. That's... Like, you know, the world we like that. Yeah.
If you're going to blame me for my choices, you better actually give me some.
Right. Yeah. This,
I think instead of choices, we have selection options.
Sure. Yeah. It's absolutely a very different thing, right? It's like, you know, are you going to blame me for having too much sugar when my only choices for survival were to eat too much sugar?
Right.
Like, how does this work? Explain this to me again. One more time. Yeah.
It's also interesting to me on the cliche of sugar that up until really recently in human history, sugar wasn't really a thing. Like you couldn't get refined sugar. It's part of an industrial process. Like it used to be the case that the only sweet things that people had access to were fruits out in the world and honey, which was often the most concentrated sweetness that you could get your hands on anywhere,
right?
Which is why it was so valuable and it stores well. But the obsession with sugar and how detrimental it is to people's health is not actually a choice that any of us wanted to make.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Nobody's threatening to burn down the fucking muffin factory if they don't put more sugar in the muffins. Nobody's demanding that.
Yes.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, I was speaking of other cliches.
Yeah.
I was listening to the radio and they were talking about how people who have issues processing sugar, like people who have metabolic disorders like diabetes and stuff like that, oftentimes would benefit from a weight loss drug like the new one Ozempic or whatever, but health insurance companies for a very long time have not covered weight loss drugs because of the associated risks and a bunch of stuff, like when everybody was taking fenfen and they all got heart disease. They were talking about on the radio about how there's all of this medication now that nobody can access through insurance, even though it might actually have discernible health benefits, because of the cliche of diet pills being so bad for you. And now that there is potentially a drug on the market that isn't as bad for you and could maybe help you lose some of the weight, which in turn would, in a roundabout way, impact the metabolic relationship that you have with sugar if you have a problem processing it and storing it and you have glycogen problems. They refuse to even look into covering those new weight loss drugs under insurance because the cliche is that these drugs are always bad and they're always elective. Isn't that interesting? I mean, that's really interesting. Like, insurance companies are rejecting the possibility of collecting a ton of money and making a bunch of money off of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. That's a weird one for me.
Yeah.
Because they're usually in such a rush to, make money off of the expensive shit.
Yes.
And have people pay out of pocket for stuff and all this other stuff. I was very surprised that more people weren't cashing in on this. It seems like a huge opportunity for several people to get really rich.
Yes. Yeah. It's,
you know, I was this is kind of like a tangent, but I was listening and reading about Ozempic and how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it interferes with how quickly your stomach processes the digestion of your food. And so the food stays with you longer, mm-hmm. which makes your body be like, oh, well, I'm not hungry because I'm already full of food.
Right.
And so you end up eating less because the biological signals you're supposed to be getting about whether or not you should keep eating food are interrupted by this drug.
Right.
And the drug slows down the processing of the food. So the food stays with you. So you're not hungry. So you eat less over time. But like if you take Ozempic for long enough, one of the side effects is that your stomach just stops digesting food.
Oh, that doesn't seem good.
Period. So there are some people now who have hyperemesis, which is where you can't stop vomiting because any food that they put in just sits there and doesn't go anywhere. Then their body rejects it and then they vomit uncontrollably. Like this one woman who they interviewed said like upwards of 10 to 20 times a day.
Oh.
And I'm like, well, you're going to get esophageal cancer from that.
Yeah, but also, like, how are you getting any nutrition whatsoever? Like,
well, that's the other problem, right? So not only are you, like, losing a bunch of crazy weight because you've basically stopped eating, but you are now lacking nutrients to, like, continue to be alive.
Yes.
And, like, it doesn't seem to matter. Like, if you stop taking Ozempic, your body's like, oh, no, we just don't digest food anymore.
Right.
So now there's these, like, women who... Like, I think the impression is that people take this as, like, a vanity drug. But, like, there are people who were told by the doctors, like, there's this miracle cure and, like, you're going to lose all this weight, which in turn is going to profoundly affect how you metabolize food, which may cure your diabetes. And people are like, wonderful. This drug, what I'm hearing you say is, this drug is going to cure my diabetes. And they're like, right, because you're just going to stop eating forever.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, right, but it's going to cure my diabetes is what I heard you say. They're like, right, because you won't be able to digest food.
Right. God.
So I was like, holy shit. There's a cliche in there somewhere, too. I'm not sure. It gets real confusing after a little while, but I'm pretty sure that in all of the double negatives that I just described, there's a cliche. Like, man.
Yeah. Somewhere in there. Somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Anyway, art.
Yes.
I don't know. Just.
So, like, what else? I wonder what other, like, other things. I think of cliches as things that kind of are intrinsically tied to pop culture, regardless of the discipline of origin, right?
So yes.
For something to become so overutilized to the point of meaninglessness, it almost has to be in the popular sphere of consciousness.
Right. Right.
Because for it to be reiterated upon and referenced so often that it becomes something else means that it has to kind of have a critical mass of knowers of the thing in the first place, which really means what you're talking about, I think,
mm-hmm.
in many or most cases would be some concept or product or idea or something that becomes so well known that it become the original ownership of the idea or the thing also becomes non-existent.
Right. So, like,
is what I'm saying making sense? Sometimes when I'm thinking, when I'm thinking through things and I talk through the things that I'm thinking about, like this happens with me and Damon a lot, where he's like, "You're asserting something," and I'm like, "No, I'm not actually asserting that I think anything is true. I'm just talking out loud about what I'm thinking about is this, and I'm wondering if this is the case."
Yeah.
Can you have a cliche that is not?
I mean, I think
pop culture.
I think what this makes me think of is like the same line of thinking would be around the idea of like, so let's look at an example cliche from the, they don't really have examples.
Right.
So let's just start with the concept, right? So the idea of like, a cliche is an element of artistic work, saying, or idea that has become overused to the point of losing its original meaning or effect, even to the point of being weird or irritating, especially when at some earlier time it was considered meaningful or novel.
Right.
Great. So the question becomes, is it a cliche only to the observer in the sense that for you, mm-hmm. The Mona Lisa is a cliche? Someone who has never seen it nor knows nothing about the context of it, seeing it for the first time, it is not a cliche experience.
I would agree with that.
Okay. So so then one could argue that for me, my experience of Andy Warhol art is a cliche because it's overused, lost all meaning, and I've experienced too much of it to a point where... you know, it doesn't seem to have any meaning. However, for mm-hmm. me, my first encounter with it, it was like, nope, this is a cliche. Now, I didn't think that at the time, but it's always mm-hmm. sat with me. And it's like not till now that I've been able to be like, oh, this is why I don't like it. Like, I didn't understand why people were so fucking jazzed about it. It's not like I like the aesthetic. I like bright colors. I like the sort of like simplicity of things.
Yes,
I
would love to hang a painting of a Campbell's soup can in my kitchen because it contextualizes why the thing that is now cliched is actually not a cliche. It's meaningful. It becomes meaningful again.
Yes.
Because it's context derived.
Right.
But like a Campbell's soup can painting in a museum.
Yes, is a cliche. Is a
cliche.
Right.
Because the context is stripped away.
Yep.
It is... picture of a thing that isn't serving its intended purpose as the thing.
Right.
It is now serving an intended purpose as a picture of a thing. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that the picture is meaningful is because the thing itself is so well known that it is meaningful. And in the new context, it becomes a cliche.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally get that. Can pop culture be meaningful without being a cliche?
I mean, that's, well, I think like if we want to go back to that concept of like the Gen Z humor and the sort of like, that is that pursuit, right? They eschew the cliche. They don't want that. They don't find novelty in the idea that like this is what we've been doing and now everybody knows about it and so now we should idolize it. It's like, no, once it's reached that point, it's like, no, it's over now. It's right. over. Like, that's not of interest anymore because that's not new and not novel and not of value anymore because it's lost all meaning because now it's pop culture.
Right.
I don't know. That's my two cents.
What about men who buy Corvettes in their midlife crisis? Is that a cliche? That's a cliche, right?
Yes. Yeah. And there's, that's actually a good example to think about because I think about it. There's multiple levels there, right? So,
yeah.
You know, what is the experience? Like, you can do, like, is eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich a cliche? Everybody does. I mean, not everybody, but like everybody, most Americans or USicans, like I'm not saying like, you know, like all of the people in America eat these things, right. but many of us in the US were raised with this being a staple of our diet at some point.
Oh, so yes.
If I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the afternoon for lunch, a late lunch, is mm-hmm. that a cliche or not? And the question, and like, my answer is like, yes. And there's also the factor of like, for my personal experience, like, am I experiencing that as a cliche? Like, what am I getting from it? I'm getting you know, it hasn't lost its meaning because its ultimate meaning is that I have this sweet, fatty, sugary, gooey mess go in my maw. And so that's the thing with the, like, buy, you know, middle-aged men buying Corvettes, right? The question becomes, is it a cliche? Like, it's a cliche for us to watch it and observe it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. man, you, like, this is, you know, I can't give you, if their goal is to have, like, the adoration and admiration of their peers and show off something or be, like, you know, then potentially they're creating cliche experience for lots of people, right? Because like, oh, right. yeah, one more fucking middle-aged white man blowing his load on a fucking red Corvette. Like, right. good job. Like, the cheapest of the sports cars, right? Like, it's just like...
You know. And one of the hardest to drive. They handle terrible.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true for modern versions, but for sure that's been like... yeah, like, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, first of all, the cliche yeah. is the fact that somebody would have a midlife crisis. And the second cliche, yeah. the like... secondary cliche is the response to the cliche of the crisis, which is to go out and buy a sports car.
Yes. Yeah. And that's where I'm wondering about the idea of like the, you know, there's that whole internal experience of the person buying the sports car. It's like, just because everyone else is, does it. It's a cliche for me. I look at it and I'm like, that's a cliche, but it doesn't mean that they don't get something. Like, there might be something about that I'm missing, right? Like, maybe yeah. it is just about driving a fast car and those are the ones that are accessible. And then maybe it's not a cliche because that's your personal experience that person's trying to have. However, one could argue that that doesn't seem to be the, like, it's for sure, like, in your usage, yes, it's a cliche. Like, oh, I can think of a cliche, middle-aged white men buying Corvettes, like, fucking done, right? Uh-huh. You know, or, like, you know, middle-aged white men, like, divorcing their wives of, you know, with three kids and fucking off and spending their money on, like, some young girl. Like, yes, yeah. fucking cliche, right?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, fucking ridiculous.
Would you, here's a question, here's a yes. side question, side sub question.
Yeah.
Would you hypothetically
mm-hmm.
get into, would you hypothetically accept a ride in a sports car that someone bought in middle age? I'd be worried that it's too much car for them too late in life. Like, do you have experience handling vehicles like this? Or am I your test dummy?
Yes.
For your like midlife initial excursions in an overpowered vehicle.
Right.
Like, I don't trust you enough to get in this car if this is the first sports car you've owned.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I just thought about that because one time I pulled up next to somebody. I had like one of the red Saturn cars that was like a two-door, so it looked very sporty, but generally was just like a sedan with like makeup on. And I pulled up next to some guy in like a Corvette one time, a convertible Corvette, and uh-huh. he acted like, you know, like, I'm gonna race you off the line or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, buddy, like, I'm not, this is not a race car that I'm in. It's a fucking Saturn car. It's like a four-cylinder engine. So I was like, okay. And then he stalled it, like, right off yes. off the mark. And yes. That cracked me up. So that is, like, my one direct experience with somebody who was obviously exercising and, like, living out the cliche of, like, someone yeah. who, for whatever reason, had waited until that point in life. Maybe they couldn't afford it. Maybe whatever. It doesn't matter, right? No judgment, per se, sure. about why they decided to get the car. It was just clear, like, I don't think you know how to drive stick.
Yeah.
And that car also seems like it's maybe too much car for you. And that just sticks out in my mind as like this moment where I thought to myself, like, this guy is such a cliche. And then that made me think, like, I don't think I'd get in a car with somebody who's that bad at driving in midlife.
Yeah. So I think, I think that's one of those things, like, you kind of have to make the judgment, right? So, like, am I, like, a young pretty girl that this guy is about to try, who wants to impress? Fuck no. Dangerous situation. Because that guy, like, is this one thing where it's like, oh, like, somebody I kind of know who's like, hey, let me give you a ride in my Porsche over to wherever. Mm-hmm. I'd maybe have to think about it. But I am with you. Like, a lot of these cars are like no joke, right? Especially if it's like they something they just got. Like, it's not fucking, you know, are you going to jump on the back of like a sports motorcycle, like a sports bike that somebody just bought?
Right.
No.
Hopefully not.
Not very different, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know. It's, yeah, I don't know. Why you got to ask the hard questions? Ask me something easy.
Would you eat sugar in a Corvette?
Yes. Especially yes. if it wasn't moving.
Yes. Especially if it was moving.
Yeah.
I think about, like, okay, so, like, a cliche is something that has lost its original meaning, right?
Yeah.
Which I guess then, of course, you have to go more backer and be like, well, how does meaning get imbued into something?
And that's where I think that's where my argument of like what meaning is trying to be derived from the mm-hmm. thing of like doing the thing, like buying the Corvette, like what meaning is trying to be derived. Like if the meaning right. is lost, then yeah, it's a cliche. But if the meaning is I want a fast sports car and then I want to drive fast and have the adrenaline rush of, you know, almost killing people on the highway and like, you know, whatever, then yeah. not so much cliche for you, but the rest of us is a cliche because like there's too many people already trying to do that.
Yeah.
It's been done. It's not, you know, it's out of the zeitgeist at this point, right?
I mean, yeah. And I think like, oh, do some things become cliche because of the just simply without trying is right. the like, so there's something that becomes popular for whatever reason. And I guess mm-hmm. we could associate the reason with the meaning of the thing, sure. right? Mm-hmm. The reason why people do it, the meaning behind the doing of the thing, or the meaning behind the cliche. So if everybody's doing something because it seems like a good idea, or it's whatever it is good enough that a bunch of people want it. If enough people reiterate on that, doesn't just the reiterative process itself create the status of cliche? Mm-hmm. Because if you reiterate on anything, eventually you'll derive new meaning from it.
Mm-hmm.
So is the fact that something becomes popular dooming it to become a cliche because the popularity, in effect, is the thing we're describing as popularity is the reiterative effect of more and more people doing the thing. And then the reiterative effect is what drives the future meaning of the thing that used to have a previous meaning. Is cliche inevitable? Is maybe yes. a succinct way of saying that. Are good things destined to become cliches of their goodness?
Sure. Yeah. Or not even, I don't know if goodness is like because of their
bad things also become cliches, but can it be avoided that a good thing will become a cliche simply because the thing that we define the parameters of its goodness by are the things that also make it a cliche?
Right. Right. I think, I mean, obviously I know the answer to this. I'm just, you know, want to like
devil's advocate me through it,
parse it,
lead
yeah.
me to the correct answer lead without giving me the,
yes,
the answer.
Yeah. Obviously, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that it's like it's a little more nuanced than just like the goodness or the bad. Like if it's really good,
yeah.
it's more like if it's appealing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then it's going to get traction and it's going to become like, really we're talking about like the idea of like viral ideas, right?
Like, yeah, or like sort memes, of like, basically.
Like memes. Yeah. The idea of like things like gaining traction in the public consciousness and then thereby becoming a cliche, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they're good or not is a separate discussion, but I think that, is it avoidable? I don't think it's avoidable. I think it's like the nature of that situation, right? Like the idea yeah. of like, you know, it's also arguable that like some things are not cliche because if it depends on your context of cliche, because if we're yeah. talking about it in terms of it being like, what's the term? Like using it in the context of sort of like not negative, but like sort of...
like they said, pejorative.
Pejorative, yeah. yeah. Like using in the pejorative, that kind of just gives the word the power of being like a flavor word in our language, right? Where it's like mm-hmm. I can add pejorative to the statement about this being cliche and convey meaning of like what do I mean when I say that? I mean like, you know, that is both a very popular and well understood and known like thought idea. And also I think that idea that you've just said, now that I've called it a cliche, is, yeah. You know, a little bit old and trite and tried and, you know, tried and like, who cares anymore? Like, let's move on. Let's, you know, this, it's a way to be dismissive of it. So it's very communicative in that context. Right. Mm-hmm. But this idea of like nailing it down to like, you know, in that context, anything can be cliche. I can attempt to, you know, call our, you know, as we both called the pejorative of our podcast, it is absolutely cliches. Two middle-aged white people having a fucking podcast, like a podcast on the internet where they just ramble about whatever the fuck they feel like and like feel, you know, what did we call this? It's like a vanity project. Like it's just, I mean, yes, 100% cliche. Like, do we care that anybody's listening? No. Like it's, you know, are there a million other people doing this? Yes. Although, you know, we like to feed our own egos because we've been doing this now for a while and we continue to bust out through the, like we're coming up on 100, 200 episodes or something like that.
I thought we already blew past it.
I think we
might've blown past it.
I don't know if we've actually published 200 episodes that are publicly available, but they will be, actually, like I can
shortly.
Look. Yeah, we can look right now.
Yeah, because we have some in the hamper that are like in posting. The
yes, in the that are future. Just waiting to.
The clean clothes hamper, not the dirty one.
Right. Although I think some of them might be a little dirty.
They're a little dirty.
Yeah. Here we go. Let's see. So Apple iTunes says we're at 196 as of right now. So when you're listening to this, there will be more. But the last one that was published on August 7th, where are all to editors? Sorry. yeah, that's I think we're our favorite, our best. We're our like our most adamant fans. Yeah, yeah, of our own podcast. Yeah,
these people are hilarious. Oh, they're us.
Yes, right.
I mean, I kind of think that's what podcasts are for, like hyper niche shit.
Yes, yes,
that right. It's kind of irrelevant whether anyone else appreciates it or not.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
like, yeah. Oh, speaking of like hyper niche shit, like this is actually not as niche as it may sound. It's going to impact lots and lots of people, but the way that these folks think about it is niche. So I listened to the Symposia podcast,
yes,
which is spelled PSYMPOSIA, Symposia, Psy, as in like
okay.
thought,
yeah, uh-huh.
mind. And they are folks who are academic researchers who discuss the ethics of psychedelic therapy and psychedelic treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a really interesting podcast. Symposia is the podcast. Plus Three is like a subset, a topical subset of podcasts that they did within the larger context of the podcast that's ongoing. And they're really cool. And I received an email from them the other day because I had placed an order on their website for some stickers because I'm obsessed with stickers. And one of the people on the podcast, one of the producers and the host of the podcast, emailed me and said, "Oh my God, did you get these stickers yet? Because I just saw this email and I don't think I sent them out." And I was like, "No, I did not. But thank you for reaching out, because if this had gone according to plan and I just sent you money and I just got stickers in return, then I wouldn't have been able to tell you personally that I am like a huge geek about your podcast. And I'm obsessed with ethics and I'm really glad you guys are talking about this stuff. So thank you."
He was That's like, awesome.
"Well, you're welcome." Yeah. So I got to talk to somebody who does a podcast who's always saying the same thing we are in our podcast, which is like, if you're out there and you're listening and you're interested in this really like weird esoteric thing that we're talking about that like a lot of people don't even have the context to care about,
right,
like you can send us mail. And I was like, "I'm glad we got to talk." Like, funny.
I love that. I mean, that's one of the things I feel about our podcast right now is like, we're at that point where like we have like maybe 300 listeners a month, like according mm-hmm. to the various statistics, and which is, you know, 300 more people than we expected nor are maybe comfortable with, but they're really, there.
Yeah, they're there.
And when we put the email out, it's like every once in a while somebody sends us an email and it's fucking delightful.
Yeah.
It's fucking great. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think about all of the things that I appreciate enough to potentially send an email about.
Yeah.
And then I just think, maybe I shouldn't send that email because it'll be like that one time that I talked to Dan Savage.
Yeah, just regret.
Just like this started out well and then I kept talking and now I'm deep in regret. Yes. But I had, that was cathartic because then I met people like after that and then they were like, no, he was really fucked up when you talked to him. So like if you thought he was responding weird to you, it wasn't because it was you, it was because of him. And then I felt better because I was like, oh good. I thought that on the like retread I had totally freaked this guy out, but no, it was fine.
That is hilarious.
Like, so then I'm always like, well, I would really like to tell these people how much I appreciate them, but if I do that, I'm not sure how it will be received. I avoid doing it, and I wonder if there's like other people out there who are like, I don't want to send them an email because like these people, whatever, fill in the blank, seem to know what they're doing, and why would they want to hear from me? Don't have a clue what they're doing, why would they want to hear from me? Like, you know, what would I even say? Like, it's just, I never thought that this podcast would pay off in any way, because we're not interested in making money from it. We're not interested in letting anybody else direct how we do it. We're not interested in changing the format to make it more or less suitable for people and get a greater audience. Like, we don't really care. We're having these conversations regardless. So we're just going to record them and like maybe somebody else finds them amusing, or Buster is listening to us and he's less anxious at home without his humans because he hears our voices, or like whatever like purpose this might serve in your life is kind of like, that's great. You can tell us about it or not, but that's probably has nothing to do with the reason we're making it in the first place. I kind of like thought like maybe after we're dead a million years into the future, somebody will just find this like weird body of work we created and they'll be like, what even is this?
I think about that a lot, in terms of, you know, the nature of the podcast, at least the one we have, it's like it's hosted on our own servers and access to it is determined by our continued existence and maintenance of that.
Yes.
And it's hard to know how to like because if you put it on like some kind of like paid hosting service, then as soon as somebody stops paying for it, it's going to go away again. And you know, recently with the unfortunate downfall of the Internet Archive, which I believe is happening as we speak.
I
haven't been keeping too much up on it, but it's a nonprofit, and I feel like I'd read somewhere that they were potentially going to. So the Internet Archive is like originally was the Wayback Machine, and what this was, we've talked about it on the podcast before, but what this was a service that basically, like, if you're not really familiar with the way the architecture of the internet works, just everybody knows there's a bunch of collections of web pages, and like most people interface through it by like some common search vehicle like Google or Bing or Yahoo or whatever. But the way that you access somebody's web page or their internet site is either directly or through finding it through searches, etc.
Yep.
And the Internet Archive basically crawls the web automatically and then archives states of those pages. So like if I have, you know, fcbm.io, which is our web page, like the internet, if you go to the Internet Archive, like at some point it may have found a link on the internet that led it to our web page. And then when it finds that link, like some other, you know, some web page it already knows about links. So once it finds that link, it then stores a copy of the web page as it was. Yes. And so over time, it's going to show, like you can look on the Internet Archive, like you can look back in time. In an ideal world, they'd have infinite resources in order to archive everything. And you'd be able to look at any web page and just see snapshots through all time, right?
Yes.
However, space and time and resource, et cetera, are limited. So oftentimes, the more popularly visited pages are the ones that have a more deep history of like archiving in their service. But it's this amazing idea that's like public service. And my understanding is like it's kind of a hard thing to meet, right? Because it's a nonprofit organization,
right?
Which means, you know, also it's like storing a snapshot of the entire internet is a fucking like untenably difficult problem, right?
It's what does it say here? It says the Internet Archive is a nonprofit library of millions of free books, movies, software, music, websites, and more. Search the history of over 829 billion web pages. Like that is an unfathomable volume of stuff. Like, that's impossible to actually comprehend how much stuff that is.
Yep.
And to keep copies of all of it, or even just like the images of the front pages of the stuff, or like, you know, to whatever depth you capture and retain each of these individual things that you're counting, like, the problem only gets larger and larger and costs more and more.
Yeah.
Until it becomes impossible to actually encompass that.
Yep.
I mean, they should just start storing all this on DNA.
Yep.
There's your solution.
Yep.
Put it on DNA. DNA works to store all kinds of shit.
Yeah. Get on it. You guys go do that.
God, DNA is such a cliche. Everybody has it.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Anyway, the Internet Archive, I'm just reading a news on their webpage. Mm-hmm. So I was wrong. I don't think it's dying necessarily, but they're facing legal issues.
Hyperlink here. Our fight is far from over. Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah. So they, this is a whole podcast in and of itself. So I've just encouraged users to look up the Internet Archive and then go, like, you can Google Wayback Machine is my favorite way to find it. But you can find an article about it. But essentially, my understanding is that the Internet Archive operates as a library. I've checked books out from it, like digital books and things.
Yeah. Yes.
It's pretty awesome. And they're getting challenged by copyright holders and whatever, you know, a bunch of people who
Hachette, a publishing company.
And so, there was a primary judgment that I think is going to not look good, but then they did an appeal, but I think that they're not sure, how that's going to go. And I'm not actually sure what the fallout is from that, but it would probably curb a lot of the functionality of the Internet Archive, to the point where it's pointless, right? Like, it's like it can't do any of the great value and good that it provides our society because it's not allowed to.
Yes. Right.
And to be clear, I mean, this is like one of those things where it's just like really obvious where it's like, it's so great for so many people, and the people that it harms are the select few who want to make more money.
Right.
Not that they're losing their livelihoods.
Right. It just means they get a little less money. And we're talking about astronomical amounts of money to begin with.
Exactly.
Like, this is not like, oh, well, I could afford bread and now I can't.
Yeah.
Because of the fucking Internet Archive. You know, they have a spinoff website, battleforlibraries.com. And it, when you follow that, it says, Battle for Libraries, the nonprofit Internet Archive, is appealing a judgment that threatens the future of all libraries. Big publishers are suing to cut off libraries' ownership and control of digital books, opening new pathways for censorship. Join 25,000 signers on the petition below to show your support for the Internet Archive, libraries' digital rights, and an open internet with uncensored access to knowledge. This is another, like, this. So the Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine is, like you said, its own podcast episode. It's so fucking cool, and there's so much to it that an hour-long episode would not even begin to cover how awesome it is and how useful and purposeful and meaningful and helpful to people it is, like, on deeply abstract philosophical levels and on just, like, concrete, like, I gotta look some shit up. Another thing that it makes me think of is, the concept of like digital rights, of uncensored access to knowledge, the concept of truth, the avoidance of censorship and stuff like that. And I think that is also like a worthy topic of its own, of like, what does it mean to have free access to something, and how you and I have been complaining like more and more frequently lately that anything about the internet that used to serve like a utilitarian purpose has been completely obfuscated by the garden walling off of information and the individual like charging of money to access all this stuff that's been partitioned out. And so now if you try to even look for information on the internet, the search results that you get back are all fucked up because the way that the internet has been walled off and put behind paywalls affects the search results that come up and your access to them. And so it's like the internet is almost pointless for the reasons that it was created in the first place because of the weird things that have been applied, the weird like boundaries that have been applied to the information on the internet over and over and over. And that makes me think that the internet itself is a cliche because the original meaning of it has been completely lost.
Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think one could argue that there's like subnets that are basically where people spend most of their time online, like, you know, Reddit being a good example. But like, that's, these companies fight for that, right? Like Facebook wants you to do all things Facebook. Countries have done this. China wants you to do all things China. If you're a Chinese citizen, it's almost impossible for you to, like, not impossible, it's very difficult for you to go outside of the controlled walled garden that is the Chinese government internet.
Mm-hmm.
Their applications and things, like their replacement apps for the stuff that the Western world provides, are heavily monitored. I mean, not that ours aren't. It's just
a different type.
Who's doing the monitoring, right?
Right.
Like these are all really problematic issues that I really feel for the younger generations that they're going to face. Like,
yeah,
you know, as we get older, it's less and less our issue and more their problem, because I mean, not that
totally,
I'm not saying it's their responsibility to fix it, I'm just saying it's like being saddled with it.
That's
like
super...
as we were saddled with shit, and it's like we were also left woefully unable to have any say in it, right? Like
hobbled,
like our generation has almost never been represented in politics. I think, Obama wasn't fucking our generation. He was older than us.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was like a bit. Yeah, isn't he like at least 15 years older than us?
I think, yeah, let's look and see.
He's born in like the 60s, maybe?
Yeah, so... Yeah, not part of the, he was still in the baby boomer generation.
Mm-hmm. He's a young boomer.
You know, not that I think that the fucking generation,
the arbitrariness of it.
The arbitrariness of it, or the assignment of values and like cohorts and stuff. But it is interesting to we have not had age representation or like cultural representation very much. Like it skipped us, right?
Yep.
You're just starting to see younger generations start to take over as the baby boomers die in the in the offices.
We just are somewhere like on the periphery.
Yeah.
So. I got a buzz in my ear from our research team.
Oh, yes.
The object color department.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's definitely probably time to wrap up this cliche of a podcast.
It's kind of funny. Like I was talking to our neighbor, who you and I both know, who is like a lovely person, and they were saying like, I like your podcast, but I have to be honest, and I hope you're not offended by this, I think I enjoy podcasts with a little higher production value.
Yeah, I want to text them and be like, I just heard. Is this true?
It got back to me that
you
might have said something along the lines of, you don't like our podcast as much as the better produced ones.
Is there anything I can do to change your mind? Like, what can we do? How can I fix this terrible situation?
I would like less talking, more interstitial music, and a point.
And a point. Yeah.
Point to what you're saying.
Yeah. It's like the antithesis of everything we do on this podcast. Right. I mean, I'm with them, right? Like that's the shit I like to listen to if I listen to anything.
Too.
Like high production, what's the Audio Lab or whatever out of New York City? The
Radio Lab.
Fucking great, right? Like just super overproduced, super intriguing, like constantly feeding my brain with interesting sounds and tidbits.
Yes.
Well thought out arcs of writing and
I think of like Ira Glass and This American Life as sort of like it wasn't a radio show per se, but it wasn't quite a podcast either because it wasn't hosting on the internet. It was like syndicated over NPR or whatever.
Yep,
but I feel like the reason Ira Glass's formula is so repeatable and so typical, and like the show itself is so recognizable, is that the formatting of it was a big enough departure from your average radio show and a big enough move towards what would become podcasting that it needed to be identical to itself and follow a highly produced format to be recognizable and digestible by people week after week after week, right?
Yes.
Yep. And so then I think that people just came to expect, like, oh, I want Ira Glass levels of like production and soundtrack and editing and scripting and all of this stuff and interviews and like this highly produced, highly time consuming shit that requires like expertise and knowledge and like a staff of people working on it to make it, to make something repeatable and recognizable as itself requires a huge amount of effort and a huge amount of deselection of things that don't fit that mold. And I'm like, that is like, that is definitely one way to do it. And I appreciate shit like This American Life or whatever that's like, oh, it's the thing and I'm waiting for the thing and I'm going to get the same thing every week, even though it's a different thing every week. It's still recognizable because it's still in some ways the same.
Yeah.
And then I think of like all of these other podcasts like ours or like Symposia, which is generally much better. Like it's more produced because they have like specific topics that they talk about, but it's just like these people talking about their own experiences and their opinions as experts, academics, or people who are in the like culture that they're referencing. And I think one of the reasons that I like the Symposia podcast so much, and one of the reasons I like the Maintenance Phase podcast so much, is that they're very spontaneous and they're very like, whatever the conversation is happening at the moment, that's what the podcast is about.
Right.
And so it's like I appreciate the fact that it's people like coming up with the content as they go.
Yeah.
Which is basically how we do it too. I mean, you and I are like, oh, we send each other texts all the time. Like, here's a good podcast title, because the title arises from some experience that we had. And then we want to talk about the experience, and that's how we get the title.
Yes.
And so like our production is really a process that we follow, but it's like a super skeletal process.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Yep.
Anyway, I don't know. One thing that we do.
Yes.
Is
you said doo-doo.
The doo-doo is the color of the day, which we do like produce in some ways. Like
so
that follows a
the process. Research team sent us, actually they sent us one, but then they sent us another one. Do you want to choose between them? Which one is going to be the colors of the day?
Well, you know, this is a tough one because they're not altogether completely dissimilar, but they are definitely not the same. And they give very different like feels. The first one that they sent us gives me like the essence of Easter.
Yep.
And
so
this,
should we just go with four colors today?
Yeah, we're going to do all four, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
So the first set of colors that we were presented with by our research team.
That's more of a pairing.
Yeah, it's a pairing. I'm sorry. That would be more of a pairing. I don't know if I'd call these colors funky. The first set of colors is a pale sort of seafoam green and a very lovely pastel purple. And they remind me of like the pastel colors of Easter.
Yes.
Like I went to this one Catholic church that was like, when I was growing up, was a really modern architectural style, because the old Catholic church that had been there for a million years burnt down. And so they had a lot of decor in the church that
I mean, it's not funny a church burnt down. I just like, oh, surprise twist, it burnt down, that's why we had a new one,
right? It's kind of like, what? And it was built on the site of the old one. It's kind of it's like super weird. So the decor inside of the church was also very modern and not very churchy at all. And one of the things they had inside the church, which is essentially like the same shape as a big box store, was like, it was just this giant square building that was all one room on the inside. And from the floor to this very, very tall ceiling with skylights in it, they would hang these just like strips of textiles in different colors, and the colors would change thematically with the season. Or
oh,
like
sure, yeah.
Whatever the
like big banners, colored banners.
Yeah, big banners. Just plain. They didn't have logos or anything. They didn't have wording or writing or text. It was just these long sort of draperies that hung straight down at the front of the church behind the altar. And like, I guarantee you that these object colors, the seafoam green color, And I'm saying seafoam green just because that's probably a crayon color that people are familiar with. Mm-hmm. Our team titled it Handcrafted Chicanery, which yes. I think is perfect for a church setting. The RGB value of handcrafted being hyphenated, of course, handcrafted chicanery, RGB value 151,230,212, RGB 151,230,212. If you type into a Google search box, RGB, and then the numbers 151,230,212, you will end up looking at the same color we're looking at. The other alternative way to do this is to type in the hexadecimal number of the like alternative code for numbers on the internet.
Yeah.
Hashtag or octothorpe 97E as in Edward, 6D as in dog, 4. So it's alphanumeric.
Yes.
Either way you do it, you'll get the same color showing up on your screen, assuming that, you know, there's slight differences in how people tone their screens. The second one, the purple.
Yes.
Which is just like such an Easter egg dye color, if there ever was one.
Yeah.
Oh my God, so purple. It's like a lilac purple. Titled Hemispherical Pretense. And the RGB value is 159,149,224. So a series of three numbers separated by commas, 159,149,224. And the hexadecimal code for this number is hashtag or octothorpe 9F as in Frank, 95E as in Edward, 0, the number 0. So this, like, these two, a lot of times, like, our colors will come up and they don't necessarily, they're not part of a coherent theme with each other. They're not matched because they're complementary. They don't have some, like, mathematical relationship to each other or anything like that. They're mm-hmm. just number, or just, colors, and we do them in pairs because, you know, we're twice as good as Pantone.
Yes,
is
right.
Why.
365 times two better right. than Pantone.
That's right. That's a lot much better.
Colors of the day. I guess not 365, but however many. We do what? Podcast every week, so 42 weeks-ish or whatever. Anyway.
Yeah, it's like over 100 colors.
Yeah.
So these two are, like, in this case, colors that would be really great together in a theme. Like, you could totally use them together. They go great together. You would have, like, people would look at it and they'd be like, these color pairings are the equivalent of a well-produced podcast in that they're not just thrown together randomly and on the fly.
Yep.
The second set of colors we got are also excellent. Would you like to describe them?
Yes. So the secondary set, let me pull them up here. Shoot, where did they go? They've disappeared. There we go. So we've got two colors, two more colors than usual. We've got fastidious dot and divisional self-sameness. Mm-hmm. So fastidious dot is like a dark navy blue.
Yeah.
Divisional self-sameness is a different tinge of that sort of seafoam green, right?
Yes. It's a little brighter and a little yellower, I think.
Yes. So the fastidious dot, again, type this right into Google. It'll pop up right for you. You can just put hashtag 0F1951. So then if you're visualizing, the RGB values, I think, are a little bit easier. So the red value of 15, the green value of 25, and the blue value of 81. Mm-hmm. So it's dark, right? So each value could go up to 255. So the 15, there's very little red. There's just a little more green than there is red. And then there's a good healthy dose of blue, you know, like two-thirds mm-hmm. value, or not two-thirds, like a third or a half value almost, or a little less than half value of blue. So it's this dark navy blue. So fastidious dot. And go ahead.
What I like about the RGB values is, like, it reminds me of that movie, This is Spinal Tap, where they're like, oh, tell us about your amplifier. And he's like, well, this one goes up to 11. And they're like, well, isn't, like, 10 usually, like, the max volume? He's like, right, but this one goes up to 11. And I think about these colors, I'm like, these go up to 255.
Yeah, these go up to 255. Yes, exactly. He's like, well, couldn't you just make 10 louder and then have 10 be the, why do you have to make it 11? But it goes to 11. Like, there's just like no understanding. Yeah. It's like, well, what if you just adjust your scale, but still have it as powerful? No, but this one goes to 11. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we can talk about why where the 255 comes from in some other time, but it's okay. So then the divisional self-sameness, the RGB value for that is 139, 243, 207. So much brighter, lighter colors. And you can see it's like it leans green because the 243 in the center. And then it also leans blue with reduced red at 139. So blue is 207. So to see this color in Google, just type in hashtag 8BF3CF. Again, that's hashtag 8BF3CHF.
Excellent.
Yeah. So divisional self-sameness. So if you're going to work with these colors today in your art and design, don't eschew the idea of using a fastidious dot or a divisional self-sameness to help highlight and accent your whatever endeavors you're working on.
That's
dress
right,
for success today.
Yes. Yeah. With hemispherical pretense.
With hemispherical pretense. Exactly.
And handcrafted chicanery.
Exactly. Yes.
What I also like about our research term is that occasionally they will use terminology that I had either not been aware of as a word.
Yes.
Like, oh, that is a word, isn't it? I guess. Uh-huh. Or like words that I'm just completely unfamiliar with and have to actually look up the meaning of.
Right. Right.
It's great. It's a whole, it's like colors and art and numbers and meaning.
Yeah.
What more do you need?
What more do you need? Well, I think, do we have anything else for our listeners today, or just thank you very much for listening?
Just thanks for listening.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Don't forget to email us. Okay. Bye.